You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hi, this is Jay Horowitz, the first outside edition of Amazing Mets Alumni My Podcast. Sitting here in the fields of Cooperstown with Cleon Jones and Ron Swoboda. Gentlemen, let me ask you one personal question. Have you guys ever gone through an 0-for-34 slump in your life?
I've had a couple that went and seemed to go deep into the 20s. I don't know if I remember 30, but
how about you, Clay? Ever go over 34?
I can't recall. Maybe it happened, but thank God for me, I can't recall.
Well, Gil Hodges went over 34. Yeah. First 34 times he's on the ballot for the Hall of Fame, he didn't get in. If memory serves me correct, he's the first player on the writer's ballot. He gets 60% of the votes three times and not get in. But we're here in Cooperstown, finally, 15 years after Gil's death in 1972, Gil Hodges is finally a Hall of Famer. And you guys are here for clear. So what do you feel about that?
Well, in my opinion, Gil was a tremendous ball player. He was a prototype for first baseman. Had a great career, and I don't think going 0-for-32 should define your career. And maybe it's the time that he went through it, doing the World Series and the playoffs, that kind of thing, that he went through it. But suddenly, to me, he was a Hall of Fame player because he was a prototype, and he would have been a Hall of Fame manager had he lived.
How about you, Ron? What's your recollection?
Yeah, I feel the same way. It always seemed to me a corruption of the process that you either had to go as a player or as a manager, right, and that you couldn't combine those two efforts. And, you know, Gil lost a couple of years to World War II as a player, so they were seasons you couldn't make up. And, of course, his untimely passing at the age of 47, interrupted what was going to be a great managerial career. You didn't have to extrapolate a whole lot in my book or combine those two things and what he was as a person, as a character, and as a leader to create a world, a Hall of Fame guy.
You guys have told me Gil was a manager ahead of his times. What did you guys mean by that? I mean, everybody really said that he was a manager ahead of his time.
Well, in my opinion, he was the greatest manager that I played for. And I say that because I played for Casey Stengel. I played for some, and he was considered a great manager. He managed great teams. Gil was good in the sense that he was complete deal. And what I mean by that is that he was good with pitchers, he was good with position players, he was good with players that was on the bench. He inspired them to stay ready. If you never know when you're going to go in a ball game, and you know it, never know when you're going to pinch hit. So you have to stay ready. So you have to have a mindset to do that. Everybody knows that the 69 Mets was a platoon team. We only had four regulars on that team. So all the other guys had to platoon, and they had to have a mindset to do that, because you couldn't have a letdown when your lineup changed. And that's what Gil preached. That's what he managed. And as a result, that's the way we played.
But you're right.
To carry on with what Cleon was talking about, Gil was asked in something I remember reading about, are you a platoon manager? And he said, I am with this team. And he was referring to 1969. He platooned because that's what made the 1969 Mets the best they could be. And you know, in this age of analytics now, where so much is in graphs and statistics, Gil had all that in his head. And he was, as a manager, in game, always ahead of the game, always ahead of the game. And when I was writing my memoir, I remember going back and looking at all the play-by-play sheets from 1969, all the decisions he made in-game. And it was astounding and incredible how on he was. And, you know, he knew how you were going as a player, how, if you were on an upswing or a downswing, and that had a lot to do with the moves he made or did not make.
Clint, in your book, you have a book coming out on August 2nd, Coming Home, and one of the things you talk about, and I'm correct, in a game, a doubleheader against Houston, we were going badly, and Gil came out to left field to talk to you. It was a ball fell in front of you, and people misconstrued it to think that he was yelling at you, but why don't you tell about the conversation that actually took place that day?
Yeah, well, I'd like to begin by saying Gil was a personable guy. He wasn't the type that yelled, and he wasn't the type to disrespect a player situation. But he was one that wanted everybody to understand that there was a need, and we were getting our tails kicked by Houston. The field was wet. It had been raining all day, and I had a bad ankle. Gil and I had talked about it in Montreal, and I said, as long as I'm not hurting the team, I want to stay on the field because I'm swinging the bat good. And we agreed on that. But Gil saw something else in this ball club. He looked around, and he saw that nobody was concerned about what was happening. And that bothered him. So he sort of gave a wake-up call to the entire team.
He used you as
he used me for the wake-up call because it was a perfect situation. It was a perfect situation to get everybody's attention. I'm leading the league. I'm leading the team, and I'm a team leader at that time. And said, well, if I can, I know Jonesy can handle this. I'm putting myself in this position now. He can handle this, and we can get through this, but we have to get through to this other guy. It worked.
Well, it worked for me, I'll tell you that, because oddly enough, Jay, and this is, I was the player that he substituted for Cleon when he, you know, took so long to take Cleon out of the game. And there was a message transmitted. Boys, you better wake up and look like you're a little worried about this. Mm-hmm. And I actually got hot and played on from there, so...
Buddy Howson, when he told me the story, he walked out to left field, and everybody thought he's making another stop, and he kept walking and walking and walking.
I thought he was going to take the pitcher
right, out. That's what they said, yeah.
And he walked by the pitcher, and that's when Buddy said, when he walked by the pitcher, he said, what did I do?
Yeah, okay. And then when he walked by Buddy, I said, what did I do?
You had your... ups and downs. I mean, he got on.
Ups and downs would be it. Yeah, we had a fractious relationship. Yeah. I didn't handle authority very well, right. And that was on me. I my immaturity and maybe thought I knew more than I knew. But Gil and I grated on one another, and that, as I said, that's on me. Because all he ever wanted you to do was get yourself ready, make yourself into the best player you could be, and maybe go out there when you needed to or when he wanted you to, and see if you couldn't help the New York Mets win and act like an adult. And I could do some of that some of the time, but not all of it all of the time.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
He wasn't a big meanings guy, right?
No.
He didn't meet...
But I think Ronnie put his hands on the pulse when he said he wanted you to be an adult. And that was on the field and off the field because we had dress codes. Nobody else had dress codes during that time. But when we came out of our room at the hotel, we had to have on a jacket and most of the time all of us had on ties, but you had to have on the jacket. So he wanted us to be professionals on the field and off the field, and he wanted us to be a team, because when you put in motion the things that a team should do to win, and you preach and practice that every day, somehow everybody gets the message. But it took, to, in my opinion, that day that he came on the field and pulled Cleon out of the game, that wake-up call was loud and clear to everybody, because all the talk at that time was, well, maybe he'll come and get me later.
Yeah.
But I was never embarrassed by it, because we had that talk. I didn't try to explain to anybody what had happened, but deep down in my heart, I knew what happened and why it happened.
What was the talk in the locker room after that game? I guess it was a doubleheader loss that day, right?
Well, you know, this was, if you look at what the Mets did against the Astros in 1969, we were their whipping boy. Mm-hmm. I mean, they beat us 10 out of 12 games. I think we won the first two and lost the next 10. You know, we made ourselves look silly playing the Astros. They beat us up. I mean, they didn't just beat us; they beat us up. And I think that got in Gil's craw at a certain point in time. You know, he was thinking, I gotta give a message, and he wasn't big on clubhouse talks. Most of what Gil felt about things would be in the way what he would do as a manager. You knew where you stood with him at all times.
Hey guys, listen to me to you. 60 years of Mets baseball. Your championship is probably one of the most iconic championships in basketball, football, hockey. You know, and 60. You know, so it's 69. 31, 53 plus years later, that you guys are still held in awe. I mean, it's not the normal championship. What does it mean to be remembered, being a part of a team like that?
Well, it's certainly great to be the first. It was the first win. And my wife always put it in a delicate manner, 7 years of perfection. It took us 7 years to win our first World Series. And when you go from the bottom to the top, and that length of time, it speaks to the organization. And I tell everybody that the organization is not just on the field; it's the entire organization, from the front office to the field, and everybody in between. That's how you win championship, and that's what happened to us in '69.
Right. Yeah, and I think the sort of unpredictability of it. We had come from a team so lightly regarded, even in 1968, where, you know, we were still under 500, but we were starting to sneak up on respectability. But we really, I think, vaulted into respectability and relevance in 1969. It happened during the season. We started out just kind of hovering around 500, which in the overall look at the franchise was improvement, but we weren't astounding anybody. And then all of a sudden, the end of May into June, that team reeled off 11 straight wins, and we beat the California teams at Shea in a series. All three of them, and then went out on the road and continued it in California. And that's when the team made the deal for Don Clendenin. That, they made it after that run, because we kind of opened their eyes a little bit, but it happened very quickly.
Kind of the old-time Keith Hernandez trade, right? I mean,
It really was. I mean, you know, Clendenin, not only as skill-wise, was a guy who brought power, but he brought personality as well to the clubhouse. He was a guy studying to become a lawyer, and he was what they called back then a clubhouse lawyer. He had a little bit to say about a little bit of everything, But he was the only clubhouse lawyer I ever knew that went on and became a lawyer and practiced law.
So let me ask you about your book again. You know, coming home, after you stopped playing, you could have stayed in New York, endorsements. What made you go back to the Mobile with Angela to help rebuild the Africa town where you lived? And
well, my career was handed to me on a platter by my community. And most people won't understand what I'm saying or what I'm getting at. I came up in a community with a lot of talent, a lot of players who I thought were much better than me, much better than Tommy, that could have played in the major league. So it propelled me to be a better player and to understand that the sky is the limit. You know, a lot of guys get around, they brag about, you know, I can do this, I can do that. But they're just borderline players. But when you don't have a limit and the sky is the limit, you keep pushing. And I think that's what happened to me. I wanted to prove to my neighborhood that they produce a quality athlete and a quality major leaguer. And nothing was going to stop me from doing that. So my neighborhood was my inspiration. You know, it's good to have a family that you're playing for, and it's good to have a brother or sister, even a close friend. But when you're playing for a neighborhood, that there's no time for letdown. You that's in the back of your mind all the time, and you're trying to prove a point that a boy named Cleon Jones can come from Plateau Africa Town and become a major league player. Right. And that was always out
pushing you forward.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Ronnie, your book, when I read, you know, everyone talks about the catch in the World Series. You know, I guess it would be fair to say you weren't known for your defense. Is that pretty?
I conventional wisdom did not describe me as an above average outfielder.
But you know what people say when you have a remarkable year, weird things happen. Against the Cardinals, Steve Carlton strikes out with 19, 20, I forget what it was.
19 guys.
And
it was a major league record at the time.
And you hit, struck out twice. You had two run homers in a game. And the night before, the late Ralph, dear friend for all of us, had given you some batting tips.
Day of the game. Day before, really. They had one of the few batting cages.
Right.
And one of those wheel machines that flipped the balls to you. And I just asked him to go down. I was just, you know, and that was a makeup game. And I asked him to if he would work with me a little bit. And kind of got me going. You know, Ralph had a good feel for it. I should have spent more time. Two things. I should have spent more time talking to Ralph and having him work with me as a hitting coach. And I should have listened to Cleon Jones, who technically knew more about hitting than anybody on that team.
But is it fair when in a championship season, like this current Met team, I think got 7 runs in the ninth inning one time, 5 in another, to come back when things like it happened, Carlton strikes out, whatever, and we still win the game.
Well, you know, nowadays, you know, where guys, you know, it seems to be a little bit of a change in baseball this year and in 2022, where you seem to see more teams, the Mets among them, and San Diego, whom the Mets are playing right now, have taken on a little more contact attitude, hit the ball the other way, two strike approaches, where they're trying not to strike out, where they're trying to make some good solid contact rather than, you know, launch the ball at an angle that maybe it leaves the yard. I'm seeing more of that now in baseball, but back then we just tried to hit the ball.
See, my memory's going bad in my old age. The ball on the wall, that was 73, right? Not 72?
That's 73.
Another weird thing that happened was the Black Cat game. We're playing the Cubs. You know, the Cubs, we have been chasing them, and in the middle of the game, or the first inning of the game, Black Cat wanders in front of the dugout and steals at Leo DeRocher, mm-hmm. some of the other guys in the dugout. What do you remember about that game?
Well, I remember it kind of put Leo DeRocher on stage. Yeah. that particular, when the cat came out across the field, and we were playing the Cubs, and everybody thought it was because of Leo that that happened. I'd never encounter a cat at the stadium before that night.
There were a lot of them, though.
A
lot of them.
And there was a lot of rats, too.
I remember hearing Don Clendenin tell somebody, a media person, that we had actually trained the cat. And it's like, no. It just came out, and the cat was utterly terrified in onto the field. But the cat, like, it looked like we had trained him to run right in front of the Cubs' dugout. And, you know, it was uncanny. And those were very compelling series with the Cubs in 69, because that was the team eventually we had to beat.
Right.
And we had a struggle, staying with them. They had a six-game lead or so, and going into August, where we were playing great, we couldn't catch them. And, the Black Cat came out, and all of a sudden their fortunes turned. Now, I think it was more they just hit a lull. Yeah. And for about 10 days, they hit a lull. And they were a four-man pitching rotation with one guy in the bullpen they could really depend upon. That's skinny.
Yeah.
And that's what we mean when we say Gil Hodges was a total deal as a manager. He protected his staff. He didn't overuse any reliever. He put guys in. He took guys out. When you the Cubs, you got two or three decent starters, but you got one man, Phil Regan, in the bullpen.
Who works for the Mets now?
Yeah. Right. Right. So. You use him. Well, you know the old saying, say, I don't mind you using me, but don't use me up.
Yeah.
That's what he did. He used him up.
What does it mean, you guys personally, to be here in Cooperstown on a day to Gil, our Chomsky and Ed Cranepool joined us here? What does it mean for you guys to be here to witness this long overdue selection?
Yeah, I'm tickled to death. We saw Gil Jr., last night for a brief period, and he's all smiles, and you were very instrumental in sort of directing us in a bit of a
campaign.
Well,
we always worked together. It was a good team.
Well, you pointed us every time there was a writer or someone who wanted something on what we thought about Gil Hodges as a Hall of Famer, future Hall of Famer. We made the best case we could make at any time, anywhere that anyone asked. And I didn't have a great deal of trust in the process. I felt like the fact that he wasn't in the Hall of Fame was an indication that the process was all wrong.
Right.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Eventually it got in front of the right people. And he was honored in a way that he should have been honored a long time ago in my book. So we're over the moon happy at this whole situation.
Well, my thing is that he died at a young age. Gil would have been, again, a Hall of Fame manager. The Mets would have been a more successful organization.
Right.
With Gil and Johnny Murphy and all those. Always put the right pieces in the right places. That's the mark of a good and solid manager. He did that with minimal talent. We had a great pitching staff, and we had great arms, and we had guys who had great arm strength and those type of things. But he managed them in a way that he brought them along slowly so that they could be of use in the future. That's a guy with a plan. He had a plan to make this organization one of the best that it could be. And it would have happened had he lived. So, again, he would have been a Hall of Fame manager had he lived. This organization, again, we talked about 69, was practically put on the map because of that ball club.
I want to, Cleon was a part of an example I would make of Gil's creativity. We're late in an extra inning game, against the Giants in Shea Stadium with Willie McCovey up, and we got like a one-run lead. Tommy Agee had hit a home run. I think we had a lead, and the Giants were threatening. He put four outfielders out
right
there,
there.
And Cleon moved from left field into kind of left center, and McCovey, I think, was the hitter, and he banged it up against the left center field fence. Nobody would have gotten to that ball if Gil hadn't rearranged it. Now, he couldn't predict that was going to happen, but it was like, we're not going to have any doubles here. Mm-hmm. And so he, when he needed to be creative, Gil was very creative, and I think as a manager, it was all dictated by the game. Nobody was on the game, and we all understood what he meant. I played for Gene Mock, who, you know, everybody recognizes as a genius, but his genius sometimes could elude the players in the sense that they didn't quite understand all the time what he was trying to do. You know, that's not a negative in the sense of, you know, it was up to you to understand it. But when Gil did something, you understood exactly what he meant, whether you agreed, disagreed, or otherwise.
Yeah, well, you understood what was happening. But it seems like to me I was always in the midst of these movements. Because I remember there was a time when I forget who we were playing, but he brought me in from left field between first base and
filled up the infield, mile, yes.
Because there was a possibility of a bunt to move the runner over. So I'm right there. The guy can swing and hit a line drive. But that told me one thing, that he appreciated my ability and my skill, that I could handle that. I could make the play if that was a bunt, to get the double play or at least get the force runner. That even though I was outfielder, I could make those kind of plays. And that happened three or four times during the course of the year. And that shows his genius, as I see it, of his talent to handle men and to put men in the right position to be winners.
Guys, last question. August 27th, first All-Timers Day game in 22 years, 65 guys coming back. You guys gonna want to play? Watch play.
Well, I want to play. Look here, and my mind said, "Yeah, let's do it." Yeah, but when I stand up, and I got to wait till I gather myself to make the first step.
Right.
I don't know if that's wise. You know, I got to go back home and do some work.
Yeah.
And if I'm not around, the work ceases to be done.
Well,
so
let's see.
Ronnie is eager to play.
But so, I can't go out and play.
Yeah.
I don't think
you don't want to get in bad pitch hit, pitch run.
No? Maybe if they promise to soft toss it up there, I might be able to take a couple of ugly looking hacks right at it. But
what it got, Frank Thomas, an original Met, 1962, 92 years old. He hit a home run in the Polo Grounds. He hit a home run in Shea Stadium. He says his goal to hit a home run in Citi Field. You think he'll do it?
Well, I know Frank Thomas, the real Frank Thomas. I think he'll try.
Yeah.
he was a pretty good hitter, but I'll tell you what. Yeah. I got a picture of the aftermath of Bobby Thompson's home run that
right
won the playoffs in the National League for the Giants back in 1951, I believe
right
it was.
Right.
And Bobby Thompson came to an old-timers game and hit a home run at Shea Stadium as an old-timer.
Really?
And I'm sitting next to Tug McGraw, our great and famous left-handed reliever. And Tug, who came from San Francisco area, said he did the Russ Hodges call.
Yeah.
The Giants won the pennant! The Giants won the pennant! I don't think you're not going to see any of us 69 guys,
you know,
doing anything like that.
This is what I'm trying to work at a first pitch. Jay Hook, who won the first game for the Mets in April of 62, throw to Mike Piazza. Jay's kind of limbering up. He wants to gear up for one pitch. Might be a little bit behind on plate, but that would be the ideal first pitch.
Wouldn't that?
Jay hooked
that
to Mike Piazza.
Yeah, yeah. But Jay is about 86 now.
Yeah, he's a youngster.
Yeah.
Well, he's an engineer.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean,
he understood the physics of a curveball, somebody said, but, you know, understanding the physics and throwing it are two different things.
Well, guys, I appreciate your time. It's a great weekend, and I'm glad we got to this point.
Thank you, Jay. Glad to be
Cleon.
Here.
Well, thank you for having us.
Pleasure, Ron. All right. Thank you, guys. Appreciate you guys.